Mr. King, Reel 2. We're talking about your early working days, Mr. King. As an apprentice bricklayer, what were the conditions of work?
Well, the conditions were very poor, of course. There were no canteen facilities or anything like that. Just used to sit in the, I remember sitting on the cement bags and that sort of thing. There was no sort of canteen facilities at all. You just sort of almost had your bit where you were working, you know. Can't remember having any canteen facilities at all at that time.
How
very poor.
How
and of course the conditions were. I remember were 2 hours notice on a Friday, which meant that a fella could be working at, I think knocked off about 5 o'clock. Fella could be working at 3 o'clock. The foreman just used to come up and say, "Get your cards," and that was it. And he finished at 5 o'clock, so it was 2 hours notice on a Friday. The reason I remember this, of course, is that I eventually became a full-time union officer, and I think that maybe started me off in thinking, we'll have to do something about this sort of thing. That must have been an early save in your mind, but all the conditions were terrible. I mean, no thought for facilities at all. Just used to have the latrines, which is sort of trenches dug across, and open trenches with a board on the top. Terrible facilities.
How long did an apprenticeship last?
Oh, 7 years then. Well, that was 7 years.
And how did they bring you on, as a bricklayer?
Oh, there was no, you just learned by watching somebody else or going with somebody else. There was no such thing as going to tech then, of course. It was just in its infancy. People going to the tech then, it was almost unknown. I can't remember very many people of my generation going to the tech or anything like that, being any extra education facilities at that time. I certainly didn't go in. I just sort of, of course, the very nature of the job means that you're sort of working yourself out of a job all the time. You build your houses and the houses are finished and you're looking for somewhere to build somewhere else. And then you move on and, you're working yourself out, as I say, working yourself out of a job.
What was the first apprentice wage that you got?
First apprentice wages I got, I can remember, I almost sure it was 5 shillings a week.
And that was a 46-hour week, you were saying?
46-hour week, yeah.
How were those hours organised throughout the week? What was the full working day?
Oh, 8 o'clock till 5, I can remember. About 8 o'clock till 12 on a Saturday, I always worked on a Saturday morning there.
So in effect, you were probably attached to an experienced bricklayer and you just picked it up?
Yeah. That was the system, of course, yes. And then you got to be what they call an improver. As you gained experience, of course, you used to start off what they call backing up. You did the inside wall and the experienced tradesman did the outside. You sort of did the inside leaf and the tradesman did the outside, or you filled in the middle. The two experienced blokes built the coins, and then you sort of filled in the middle of a part of the job. But it was all just, there was no such sort of recognised training as such. You just sort of learned the hard way, I think. Everybody just picked up what they could, And then I started work. That was after the war, of course. Oh, no, it was just before the war. I started for a firm called Lax in Crook, who was a sort of a jobbing builder. After I'd been down to Strensel and came back then, that would be about 1937, I suppose. Came back from Strensel and my brother and I worked. My brother got to be foreman on his job, relaxed, and we were renovating Colley houses at Brandon. And you did all sorts then, of course. Right from the very beginning, you put the founts in, built the house, plastered it out, put the roof on, put the tiles on, all sort of the wet trades, you know, you did all the wet trades yourselves. So really I gained a lot of experience doing everything, you know, from putting the founts down, putting the drains in, right up to plastering and skimming and, you know, tiling, and roof tiling and all sorts, you know, so he did all sorts. And then, of course, I got the job then of Lax was, as I said, jobbing builder. And we used to get jobs, sort of paper wanting the roof repaired or the chimneys repaired or, you know, the plastering thing and all that sort of thing. So we did that. And he built one or two sort of odd houses, you know, on spec. So that was the sort of job I was doing when I was, just before I was called up into the army, actually.
What happened when it rained or snowed and those conditions?
I remember working at Catrick before the war. And I was lodging in Darlington with my sister and used to be cabined up until 2 o'clock, and then we used to make you stop there till 2, even though it was belting down with rain. It was a pad, one of those, some of those days when it was a pad, it was going to rain all day. So you kept you there till 2 o'clock, then you had to go and sign on.
You didn't get paid for that?
No. Just before the war, they brought in what they call a guaranteed wage, which was, you were guaranteed a 32-hour wait for 1 week. But that was it, that was the extent of the guarantee. But they wouldn't make sure you didn't get the guarantee, of course, that was it. It was hard going, really, at that time.
It's very physical work.
Oh, yes, aye.
Were there accidents regularly?
Oh, any amount, of course. Of course, then, the scaffolding, it wasn't metal scaffolding, it was pole and rope, you know. They used to have pole and rope scaffolding, and dependent on the skill of the scaffolding, how long it stood up. But very, very heavy physical work. You know, when you think about the 20 or 30 foot large poles, you know, and the blokes struggling to fasten ropes around and one thing and another. Very, very heavy physical work. And of course, when they used to be concreting, it was all done on a big board, and all done by hand, you know, by a shovel. And it was Mr. Going desperate for the labourers, to be honest. No mixing concrete at that time. And of course, it was all nearly all horse and cart as well, you know. I mean,
Did you pay an insurance to protect you against injury?
No, I didn't. I can't remember anybody else doing that either.
So what happened if you were injured and you had to be laid off for a week or two?
Well, you've got to, I think, remember, if I remember rightly, you used to go on what they call the Lloyd George. You know, it was sort of a scheme where you've got not recompense, but you've got sort of a benefit even at that time. Just remember that really vaguely as being on the Lloyd. You used to say if you're on the Lloyd George, you know, that the sort of a benefit that they used to get when they were sick if they were injured.
You mentioned becoming a trade unionist. How did that come about? How were you elected in effect to the trade union?
Well, I came out of the army.
Oh, this is after the war, is it? Oh, we'll leave that till then. I thought it was before the war. No, but obviously you were feeling that, you know.
Oh, yes. I felt the need for... I was in the union before the war, of course, when we moved down to York. And I was just an apprentice then, of course. But it was a Ministry of Works job, Ministry of Defence. Building the barracks at just outside York, And that was my first incursion into the union. And I would suppose it, my brothers and his mate, the Wolf, went down together. We were all lodging together in Spencer. And I would think that would be our first incursion into the union. Because I can remember this bloke coming up and saying, you know, you'd have to join the union. And that, well, would you join the union? And anyway, they joined. I didn't, because I was an apprentice. And they must have thought, well, apprentices weren't.
What was the Bricklayers Union?
It was initially called the AUBTW, Amalgamated Union of Building Trade Workers. At that time, there were separate unions for the bricklayers, for the joiners, for the painters, and the plumbers, and the slaters and tilers. They all had separate unions at that time. And the union for the bricklayers was called the Amalgamated Union of Building Trade Workers, which was very strong, actually, a very strong union. The joiners, basically, were a strong union. They were maybe stronger. There was more allegiance, I think, as a joiners, because they were more static, I think, than what the bricklayers were. Were very, very old established unions, of course. Right from the very, you know, the old Manchester Oddfellows and that sort of thing, went back donkey's years as far as the history of the unions were concerned. But very, very fragmented, of course, because, you know, you could have a bricklayer in one field working in one field, another, like the agricultural workers, blokes working in another farm 20 miles away, you know, so they were very fragmented as far as the memberships were concerned. But they had branches in, at that time, I remember, they had a branch in Bishop Auckland. And, of course, my brother was a member down in York. They joined the union in Bishop Auckland. I think they were sort of made members down in York and then transferred into Bishop Auckland, because, you know, that was the nearest union to Crook, branch to Crook.
And these were recognised by employers?
Well, no. Well, the employers didn't like it at all. In fact, the firm I worked for, Laxing Crook, was really anti-union. You know, no question about that. Didn't like it being in the union at all. And that's another story. Which you could want to. But, no. They didn't like the unions at all. And of course, they weren't recognised. I've seen they weren't recognised. They were tolerated by the employers. It was quite a reasonable setup, really. I could talk a week about the unions.
Can we move across now to? You said you were in the boys' brigade.
Church lads' brigade.
Yeah. How old were you when you joined?
Oh, I think I would be about 10 or something like that, I think. I was sort of in the junior section first, you know. We had a little forage cap and a strummer cruff, sure, like a little bag on your side, like a little white bag, and a belt, and that was the uniform, I think.
Did you have to buy that yourselves?
Oh, yes, yeah. And then I went into the senior, you know, developed into the senior section, got to be a drummer, in fact, played the drums in the band. And it was very strong, actually. A fellow called Captain, I don't know whether it was an honorary title that he had or whether it was developed from the First World War, you know. But he was called Captain Grisdale, I call him. And he was the in charge, you know. And of course, he had all military connotations, of course, in the ranks. But we used to meet on a Friday night, I think, in the church hall in Crook, and invariably go to church on a Sunday.
This was the same church as your mother attended.
Yeah, yeah. And wasn't a great deal of activities, you know. Maybe used to play basketball and stuff like that in the church hall. And then they had an annual camp. I can't remember going to many of those. I don't think I could afford, maybe couldn't afford it. I don't know what the system was, but I can't remember going to many camps, or any camps, in fact. But they did have an annual camp. I know they did go off. I think the people that, you know, that maybe the parents could afford it, they went. Well, I can't remember going now.
Did you do drills?
Oh, yes, they did, sort of, well. Oh, yes, they did drills, yeah. It was almost just to keep you where you were, where you were. But there was no sort of, wasn't sort of a strong drill discipline at all, you know. It was just sort of to get you in order to march you to church, I think. But it was a good thing. I think it was quite a good thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you personally got out of it.
Yeah, well, I think the comradeship, of course, you know, you've got to know quite a lot of other people and other lads, and it developed you with a bit of camaraderie at that time.
Did it bring discipline into your life? Basic military style discipline.
I think so. I think that's where it starts. To be honest, you know, if people in the Boy Scouts and or whatever, they should have learned some sort of discipline. You know, it was quite good. I enjoyed the Church Lads Brigade. I was really proud to be in it. And, you know, looking back in retrospect. But I think I still have some old photos upstairs when I was in the Church Lads Brigade.
And you have this Christian military element in it.
Oh, yes, yeah. It's something like the Salvation Army in that respect, you know, where they have this sort of military Christian background, you know.
And you obviously took pretty well to the discipline of in a group like this.
I always did, you know, because. I think so. I've always been amenable to discipline. You know, care to cut. I think that's really what it's all about. Yeah.
Can we go back? Because I should have probably asked you this before when you mentioned it, to the 1926 strike. You would be what, 7 year old? That kind of age. Yeah. Was your father out of work during that strike period?
No. But I can remember times were really bad. I get the impression that everybody was really struggling at that time. No, I can't remember my dad ever being out of work. But I can remember going to the soup kitchen in the Crook Council. They had them in Crook Council School, actually. In one part of the school, I remember. There was a family, in fact. As I say, I lived in West End Village. There was a big family called the Malaburns who lived just below us in West End Village. They had a very big family, about 13. And I think I can never remember the younger members of the family having any boots. Always went to school without shoes, without boots. In fact, I think the only time they ever got boots was from the place boat fund. You know, they had the local place had a boat fund, I think. But they were very, very bad. Oddly enough, Mr. Malaburn always worked. He worked alongside me and Dad, actually. And always a hard worker. But as I say, he had a very big family, 13. And I suppose wages were that low that they couldn't afford to clothe them all, you know. And that would be a hand-me-down family, you know, because, as I say, the youngest ones, could never remember them having shoes on. Obviously running around in the bare feet. That's a sad reflection, isn't it?
As a teenage boy, coming up towards the war, what were your leisure activities then?
Dancing. Everybody went dancing. used to go to the A-Light in Crook, and the boys used to be on one side of the room and the girls on the other. And of course there was a mad dash across the room, and everybody seemed to be sort of segregated each side of the room. Oh, it was dancing every night of the week, practically, I suppose. And we used to walk across to Eshwinning and Ushamua, places like that, through the week, you know, when there was no dancing at Crook. And I remember if you went to the dance on a Monday night at Crook, you got a free ticket for the Thursday night, which was old time. And the main source of income then, I suppose, as I said earlier, we used to run around putting loads of coal in to get sixpence to go to the dance. And that was even as a teenager, I must have been about 17 or 18 year old then. And we used to play snooker, of course. Snooker was a big pastime. We used to have two or three snooker halls in Crook, the Mechanics Institute and the Central and the what did they call the other one, the Temperance Club. Temperance Club was a little bit snooty, of course, it was, you know, but the others, all the young lads went in and the Mechanics and played snooker. That was about the only other activity that was going at the time, I think. The young lads didn't seem to drink then. There was no sort of, I can't remember going drinking at all, you know, when I was a teenager. We didn't think about it until maybe I got to be about 19 or something like that, you know, maybe 20.
Cinema, was there a cinema in the town?
No, two. Well, three actually. There was a theatre, what they called the theatre. But the two cinemas were the Hippodrome and the Empire. The Hippodrome was slightly a bit more classy, I suppose, than the Empire. But owned by the same firm. I think they called him Saul Sheckman, I think, was the chap that owned them. And then, there was the theatre. Theatre Royal, which had live turns on, of course, you know. And they used to change the Theatre Royal used to change its programme every week, of course. You had sort of, I think in history they had pretty illustrious turns there at one time and another. But the Picture House used to change it twice a week. You know, so you could see about four pictures every week, you know, of course.
In your young life, looking back over those years in the late 20s, 30s, had the experiences of the First World War, were they still within the community's
experience? I think so. It seemed to die off just, you know. The remembrance services, I remember, were very, very well attended at that time. You know, when I was, about 1933, 34, around about that time, they were always very, very well attended. And yes, I think the memories were very strong as far as... Of course, I think, you know, it goes back to the number of people that were killed, of course, doesn't it, you know, and especially the Durhams. The number of people that were killed during the war, and I think we're getting a revitalisation now, of course, again. Yeah.
And as a boys' brigade, Church Lads Brigade, you would be on these parades, were you?
Oh, yes. Oh, they used to do that fairly regularly. I had a feeling that I always felt a bit uncomfortable, but it still affects me today somehow, and I don't know why. That lots of these kids at the service, you know, I don't know. It just sort of makes me just feel a bit uncomfortable somehow. That whether they just don't understand, or, you know, what it's all about. And whether we should be doing that, I don't know. It, it, it just confuses me a little bit. I always did feel a little bit uncomfortable as a kid, being on these parades somehow. Because, in recollection, I think, when I was, we just didn't have any thought, it didn't have any meaning, excepting that we were getting dressed up for the day and marching to the war memorial. I suppose it did have effects, because I'm a member of the British Legion, a key member of the British Legion now. But having the kids there somehow, I was just saying to,
coming up to the late 90s, 30s, do you recall when you became aware that things weren't right on the continent again?
Oh, yes. I remember vividly going to the pictures. And, when Hitler was doing all his thing at Munich and that sort of thing, and they had all the big battalions of the Germans sailing. And what made me uncomfortable was people were laughing and thought it was funny. You know, lots of people did think that they looked, that the Germans looked ludicrous doing that sort of thing. And maybe I was a bit more far thinking than others, but, I said, my God, if they start, all these. I used to think the masses of men that you saw. I think, I don't know whether the newsreels gave a wrong impression at that time, but I don't think it registered with a lot of the British people at that time, that how dangerous the situation was. And of mine, I don't think it registered with the politicians either, but. When you think about it, when I was called up in the early days, we hadn't any rifles. That's how ludicrous it was that the Germans were there in the thousands, all highly trained and fully armed, and we were, we hadn't any rifles to start with.
Were any precautions being taken immediately before the outbreak of war in the Crook area?
Well, just the air raid precautions things. I can remember issuing the machiners with gas masks and that sort of thing. And then I don't think people even begun to think that it was really going to happen. There's a really false sense of security, I mean, that people had. It was maybe when they had the early days when, you were saying, well, it did not happen, and all that sort of thing, the old Chamberlain was flying away after me and that sort of thing, and I don't think they realised anything was ever going to happen,
Do you recall where you were or what you were doing when that announcement was made for the outbreak of war?
Yeah. My wife and I, we weren't married, of course, then, but we were staying with my sister. We'd gone on a day trip, or maybe on the weekend, and my sisters who lived in Jarrah. And I always remember well before that, if I can just go back in time, it used to test the area warnings, And I was working over Bransworth. Buildings, the new council, the new offices in Bransford. And as soon as they set the air raid warnings off, you're supposed to dash down into the drift, that was the first sort of fear everybody had, and everybody was looking frantically up at the sky to see if they were coming, But to go back to where we were when the announcement was made, we were in Jarrah, and everybody was sort of in panic stations there to try and get back to home, And the thing was, I remember my sister was with us, and thought it was too old, you couldn't get back home sharp enough, up from Jarrah, because they set the area sirens off at the same time, I think everybody was in a bit of a panic for the 20 minutes. you know.